Since 1981, Unbound has connected people like you with families worldwide on their self-directed paths out of poverty. A brighter future is possible for these families when we all walk together. Sponsor a child today, and you'll help a family take the first steps on their path. Change their future in just one click. Start walking with your new friend today at unbound.org/walk.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
Listeners of Sons of Patriarchy, Peter Bell here, producer of the podcast. Just so you know, we are turning ads on for this series, and the reason is simple. We need to cover our costs. It takes a lot of money to run this, as everything has been self-funded up to this point. We ran this past the Sons of Patriarchy team, as well as the Survivor community, and we have received the green light to act on this decision. These ads will not be intrusive, nor will they be random. They will occur at the beginning and end of each episode. There will be no interruptions during the content of each. With this decision, we are earmarking 25% of the revenue these ads generate towards outreach, which exclusively provides resources for survivors of the movements we are exposing and profiling. The rest will go to cover our costs and our time in producing the series. If you would like to donate directly to our efforts, find the outreach link in the show notes. There you can give a single or recurring donation. Along with this, we are turning on Apple subscriptions. $4.99 per month will give you access to ad-free listening. You can also sign up for the same on our Patreon account, link in the show notes. Now, let's get on with the episode. Human beings are a tribal group. You probably noticed that during the COVID pandemic. Maybe the first few days or the first few weeks weren't bad. But loneliness sure came after you as if you stole a mother's cub. More books have been written about loneliness, podcasts produced about the same, and the modern search for the historic third place. For decades, we had the home, workplace, and the church or bar or gym. But now that everything is online, workplaces are closing in favor of remote option, and churches live streaming services, we're looking for a new tribe, a new identity, a group to take us in. With everything moving online, discourse becomes depersonalized. And when discourse becomes depersonalized, relationships are built not on people, but on ideas. Ideas become forefront. They become central. They become everything. However, rallying around an idea gives many the experience of a community when we've lost so much of it. Cue nationalism. The loss of the workplace and the third place drives us online. And online discourse, having become depersonalized and centered on ideas, is a fertile ground for these conversations. The conversation we've developed over the last few episodes centered on modern Christian nationalism. Ideas have become more important than people. Ideas, you could say, have become personalized. We've always rallied around ideas, but I guarantee you, prior to the advent of the internet and online discourse, your church, bar, gym, whatever, was full of a politically, economically, and ethnically diverse set of people. You probably knew their political affiliation or their religious tradition and where they worked. You just couldn't care less. But with unembodied groups comes embodied ideas. And with embodied ideas comes tribal associations with them. The drive towards identity politics, because ideas now define us. But these ideas are not neutral, just like the political space nationalists convince us aren't either. These ideas do something. They make us into a certain kind of people. You could say these ideas produce fruit in us. And this fruit isn't always good. And that's what we're talking about here. Welcome to episode 6, The Fruits of Nationalism. In the past three episodes, we've talked about what nationalism is, where it comes from, and who the major influences were and continue to be. Now we'll talk about what nationalism does. Maybe you heard about Christian nationalism before this series. Maybe you haven't. Maybe you weren't sure if all Christians were nationalists or not. Maybe you're a Christian and a nationalist, or maybe you're a Christian and not a nationalist. What I hope to do in this episode, with the help of a few friends, Paul Miller, Catherine Stewart, Nap Nasworth, and repeat guest Russell Moore, is to discuss what Christian nationalism is doing and what it hopes to do. Let's begin with Paul Miller.
My name is Paul Miller. I'm a professor of the practice of international affairs at Georgetown University, and I'm the author of The Religion of American Greatness, What's Wrong with Christian Nationalism.
Paul might know a thing or two about politics and Christian nationalism. Most of Paul's research on Christian nationalism has been that which has existed since the mid-2000s, and particularly so after Trump. Here's Paul's definition of Christian nationalism.
Thanks for the question. I've really worked to maybe refine my understanding and my definition of it. So you won't find this in the book, but here's now my shortest definition for you. Mm-hmm. If you say America is a Christian nation and you think the government has a job to keep it that way, that's Christian nationalism. Not just the first part, not just saying America's a Christian nation, because you could say that as a historical observation or a cultural observation that we're still predominantly Christian in our, you know, demography or our outlook. But if you're saying that the government has a job to maintain and uphold and defend a specific cultural religious template for all Americans, that's Christian nationalism. Christian nationalism is a political ideology above all else. It is a political program to make America mean something very specific, to make us conform to a certain cultural Anglo-Protestant template. That's Christian nationalism. That's the hard core of it. Now, you asked, are there variations? Absolutely. And I'd say, as I have read and explored and studied this, I found there's maybe two different axes. Like, we scholars love to create our two-by-two diagrams, right? So along one axis would be whether you're talking about, I'd say, sort of bottom-up Christian nationalism, the lived experience in the pews and the trenches in politics. And then there's sort of top-down Christian nationalism, the kind that scholars write about when they are advocating the political program. And these are pretty similar, but there are going to be differences. You know, the bottom-up Christian nationalism won't always cohere as a fully internally consistent ideology. Sometimes it's more of a sentiment or a feeling or a culture more than a series of political propositions. Whereas the top-down Christian nationalism from the books, from Samuel Huntington, from Yoram Hazzoni, from Rich Lowry, that's going to be more sort of coherent, but won't always match with what is being said out in the trenches, so to speak. So that's one differentiation I'd give. The other one, if there's another axis I'd propose here, it is on, I'm going to say, sort of more moderate, mainstream, popular, and peaceful forms of Christian nationalism, which I still think are wrong. And then there is a more extreme end that has there's an extreme, even violent version of Christian nationalism. I think that we've seen that on a few occasions where some people, in the name of Christian nationalist ideals, advocate some pretty extreme stuff, or even perpetuate violence. So those are all kinds of different sorts of Christian nationalism, bottom down, top up. I got that backwards. Bottom up, top down, or more moderate and more extreme. And so that's it's a whole world of families of Christian nationalisms, plural. But I think at the core, they all believe America is a Christian nation and the government should keep it that way.
Christian nationalism is a political ideology above all else. It's meant to preserve something distinctly American, to uphold a vision of who we are. Paul brings a lot of good stuff into the conversation, as you'll hear throughout this episode. This political ideology has real-world consequences and policy initiatives that, to put it mildly, aren't good. Paul continues from the definition to describe the inconsistency and foolishness of this project. They're reacting to something above all else. What are they reacting to?
Well, they're reacting to the reality of cultural change, cultural, demographic, and religious change in America. America is a very different country than we were 2.5 centuries ago, than we were 100 years ago, than we were 60, 70 years ago. The pace of change has accelerated. And so America is quite different, and we are undergoing such rapid change. It's a very normal human reaction to be unsettled by rapid change and even to grieve what we've lost. It's true. We've changed, and that means old ways of living and being are no longer available, perhaps. And it's very human to grieve that, maybe even to be fearful of further change. And political entrepreneurs will hijack that and turn it into anger and gear that anger towards the people they think are responsible for the bad change, right? That, I think, is sort of what's going on. Let's just acknowledge the reality that, for example, the percentage of Americans who say that they are Christians is pretty much at an all-time low in American history. It's still like 70%, but it used to be basically 100%. And now we're at maybe 65 to 70%. The percentage who say that they're Protestant is at an all-time low in American history. I think it might be down to like about 50%. There's a racial ethnic element here too. The percentage of Americans who are white or of European ancestry is also at an all-time low. This can be deeply unsettling to white Christians in America. And it's okay for us to recognize the reality of that feeling, that anxiety, without maybe validating racial resentment. You know, it's not good for us to feel that way, but it's real. Like, people are out there. So that's, I think, what Christian nationalism is a reaction against. It's reacting against rapid, deep, profound cultural, religious, demographic change. It doesn't mean that they actually have the right solution. And by the way, change isn't always a problem. It's unsettling, but not always bad. Sometimes change brings in good things. America has actually changed for the better in some ways. We're a much more racially tolerant society than we were. We are more religiously tolerant. Our religious freedom is more well-grounded in our constitutional law than ever before in American history. So those are good changes, even if they feel uncomfortable for certain groups that used to enjoy social dominance. And Christian nationalism thinks that the change is a problem, and the solution they provide is worse than the disease they seek to cure.
You heard me talk about this in episode 1. Doug Wilson is a reactor above anything else. Yes, he's created and founded a myriad of institutions, and he's sort of fronted the modern Christian nationalist project, or at the very least, been its most vocal proponent. But Wilson reacts to shifting cultural currents, and so does the Christian nationalist project. They've lost the majority, and they want it back. But this reaction has shown them to be far more concerned with their national identity than their Christian one. Here's Paul Miller with more.
Which is also why we've seen the rise of more overt white nationalism in recent years. White nationalism is what happens when white, mostly white men, listen to the left and take them at their word and say, okay, if everybody else gets to advocate for their ethnic, racial, or gender identity, then white guys get to do it too. And it's particularly what happens when you get to the post-Christian right. Christian nationalism is bad enough, but it's better than white nationalism. And by the way, I had a conversation off the record with one of the advocates of Christian nationalism who told me precisely that. He said, look, I'm an advocate for Christian nationalism because it's the only bulwark standing between us and the white nationalists. And my challenge to him was, look, maybe Christian nationalism isn't the guardrail against white nationalism, but the gateway to it. And I think that's true. Look what happened this year. The Republican Party dropped its pro-life plank, yep. Right? It became a less Christian party, even as it became a more nationalist party. And if you don't have Christianity to rally your nationalism around, guess what's coming next? So I just want to shy away from all nationalisms entirely.
One strand of Christian nationalism, the one I've profiled a bit earlier in this series, is Joel Webbin. He's former pastor of Response Church in San Diego, and he fled to Texas to found Covenant Bible Church on the north side of Austin, Texas. Here's what he says about Christian nationalism and how life might be better under it.
The way that you engage is with an iron will.
Yep.
The way that you engage is you have to be ruthlessly committed to winning real, tangible, political, cultural, academic, ecclesiastical power. You must seize power. And then with that power, you then wield it righteously. And when power is wielded righteously, it is a blessing to the righteous. And it is even a blessing to the wicked if they choose to turn from their wicked ways. Everybody wins. Everybody wins. The atheist will fare much better under Christian nationalism than if Christians lose. What you'll get, which will not be a globo-homo-gay globalism.
You must seize power. You must seize it righteously. Life will be better under this schema because the righteous will rule righteously, or at least we hope they will, and the unrighteous will be forced to live under it too, so they'll know Christianity by its power. Christian nationalists are all about power. The nationalistic fervor to put everything right again. And the Christian descriptor is to make them feel better about it. Make no mistake, there's nothing righteous about the lust for power. It's anti-democratic to the very core. Anti-Christian to the very core. Don't believe me? And maybe you think I'm being dramatic or sarcastic. Here's a 2-minute clip where they say this over and over and over again.
Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans represent an extremism that threatens the very foundations of our republic.
Fuck democracy.
I want to see Antifa members hanging from gallows in Trump ties. That's what I would like to see. Yeah.
We need total dictator Trump. I seriously, and you know, there's no argument against it. Oh, the Constitution says this. It's like the Constitution is invalid.
Yes, the point of Christian nationalism, my goal is to break American democracy.
Here would be my solution. Elect a dictator, suspend the laws, dismiss the legislature, and the dictator taxes the people and uses the money to build a giant wall and uses the money to raise an army that is personally loyal to him.
People need to be tried, convicted, and executed for treason.
The greatest example of love is to kill those traitors so others learn never to do it.
We need to hold people for treason, start having some public hearings, and start executing people who are found guilty for their treasonous acts against the Constitution of the United States of America, just like they did back in 1776.
There should be military tribunals taking place right now, and people should be arrested for high treason that's been committed at the highest levels of government. Well, personally, I think a firing squad would just be great. Just put them all in, stick them up against the wall and take them out.
What does a modern-day militia look like? Because if you're like me, you see these godless commies and you're like, I want to shoot them in the face. But because you're like me and you're a law-abiding patriot, you're not going to do that because that's illegal.
Or is it? If for any reason the President of the United States feels that it's not getting done the way it should and decides to put out the tweet that says, my fellow Americans, my fellow two-way loving Americans, it's time to take up arms against these assholes. You are all fucked in under an hour.
We will then collect the power needed to silence, destroy, and imprison our political opposition.
So this fucking country is so gay. I hate this country. I hate this country. I hate this country.
If you listen to the two previous episodes, The Roots of Nationalism and The Reconstruction of Nationalism, you heard these very things. Christian nationalism is anything but democratic. It's almost comedic. Nowhere in the New Testament do you have the apostles seeking political power. In fact, they have no expectation of it. Are they hermits hiding from politics and building their own community? No. They live quiet lives under whatever regime they're under and engage them with the gospel. Lest you think this is a liberal, progressive attack on Christian nationalism, here's Paul Miller on conservatism and conservative politics against Christian nationalism.
Because it's wrong and foolish, and I think constitutionally wrong, and I think also theologically wrong. I think it's we have an obligation to call out error wherever we see it, and particularly when it's on, quote unquote, our side.
Yeah.
You know, I recall the parable that Jesus tells about, you know, look at the plank in your own eye before the speck of dust in your neighbor's eye. And by the way, I do plan to call out the speck of dust or the plank in the progressive eye. I have a book that I'm working on right now about the illiberalism on the progressive left. Mm-hmm. I'm not a lefty. Don't vote that way. Don't plan to. And, you know, I work in a university setting where I actually see that I think the illiberalism of the left up close, and I'm not a fan of it. So when I say there's a bad thing over here, that doesn't mean the stuff over there is good or there's no bad stuff over there. I don't mean that at all. There could be bad stuff on both sides. And I think there is. So I think there's an obligation for us to critique our own side, so to speak. I think that the nationalists sometimes have the opposite view, that there should be, as they say, no enemies to the right.
Yeah.
And so when they hear a guy like me criticizing the right, there's a special kind of anger that I'm committing treason against our side, that I'm betraying. You know what? I actually think I'm more loyal to the right by helping us see our flaws and hopefully get better. I think nationalism is not conservative. There's some really big differences between conservatism, the kind that I still believe in, and the nationalism that is ascendant on the political right and in the Republican Party today. And so I think I'm being sort of loyal to conservatism by calling out the errors of nationalism.
Paul's conservatism impresses upon him that he needs to fight back against nationalistic politics. Conservatism is for limiting government, and nationalism is for extending it. Paul goes even further.
Not all Christian nationalists think that. Remember, there's a spectrum of Christian nationalism, but there are some more on the extreme end who get pretty close to saying that. And by the way, that is also when you verge into idolatry. That's precisely when a Christian nationalist movement can become idolatrous, turning the nation into a god and the leader into a messiah figure. It's deeply, deeply dangerous and troubling where that could lead.
The very label Christian nationalism assumes that those who do not claim it might not belong to it. If you're a Christian and against nationalism, how do you fit in? You don't. One of the more ironic realities of Christian nationalism is how often they decry identity politics when that's precisely how they define themselves. When you define yourself and exclude others, what are you doing? Identity politics. And the vicious cycle roars on. The more you exclude, the more those who are excluded begin identifying themselves in distinction to you. Paul continues.
So as I say in the book, I think that Christian nationalism can be seen as the identity politics of the white Christian tribe in America. That's a broad generalization, but I think it's roughly true that there's a, particularly the word evangelical. So white evangelical has become a tribal identifier more than anything else in the American political landscape. And so Christian nationalism is the movement that champions the interests of that group of white evangelicals. When majority groups do this, we call it nationalism. But when minority groups do the same thing, when they gather around their identity markers and advance their interests, we call it identity politics. Mm-hmm. And so we have nationalism on the one side, on the right, for white evangelicals. We have identity politics for every other minority group in America on the other side. And these things actually feed off of each other. Because the more the big tribe, the more white evangelicals do their thing and advocate and push America to be their nation, the more they try to get white evangelical and America to equal each other, the more the minority groups feel threatened by that. And so they will naturally advocate for their interests and their slice of the pie, which the majority thinks is just balkanizing America and destroying our civilization and tearing us apart. And so they push all the harder for a strong, central, cohesive national identity around their tribal characteristics. And so you have this back and forth, this never-ending feedback cycle of identity politics and nationalism. This is what we call the culture war, as the two sides are playing tug of war to try to take over the state and use the state to endorse their identity views. And I'm sitting here in the middle like basically a libertarian now saying maybe the government shouldn't be in the business of endorsing identity claims. Maybe that's the way to out of the culture war.
Now we come to a scholar who's written on these identity markers, where they come from, who they're distinguished from, who they're reacting to, what animates them, and what their plans are. Here she is.
Thanks so much. My name is Catherine Stewart. I'm the author of the forthcoming book, Money, Lies, and God, Inside the Movement to Dismantle American Democracy, that comes out in February 2025. I'm also the author of The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. That book formed the basis of the documentary feature, God and Country. And my first book in this area came out in 2012. It's titled The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on America's Children, and really focuses on the religious right's efforts to infiltrate and also undermine public education.
God, money, power. The nationalist trifecta. What you win someone with is what you win someone for. How did Catherine get involved in the world of religion, politics, and Christian nationalism? I asked her.
These are great questions. So I first got interested in the topic in 2009. I was living in Santa Barbara, California, and a Good News Club came to my daughter's public elementary school. Now, Good News Clubs are designed to convert children in their very earliest years of learning into a deeply fundamentalist form of evangelical Christianity. They really confuse little kids who are too young to read often, into thinking their public school endorses their form of religion. What they do is they encourage these kids attending the clubs to proselytize to and recruit their classmates. I was astonished to learn that there were thousands of these clubs operating in public schools nationwide. They seemed, frankly, wildly inappropriate in a public school setting, which is diverse in our public school in Santa Barbara. You know, maybe a third of the kids, maybe a half were evangelical, but many of their parents actually objected to the arrival of a Good News Club. And that really tipped off bells to me. The evangelical parents at our school met with the leaders of the Good News Club and said, we'd like to offer you free and better space in the church that was literally next door to the school. It was a beautiful evangelical church, the Montecito Covenant Church, probably one of the prettiest churches in the country. And the Good News Club leaders declined. And I thought, first of all, what do my evangelical friends know that I don't? Number two, why don't they want to be in this beautiful church next to the school? Why do they want to be in the public school? And I recognized that they wanted to be in the public school because they were confusing little kids into thinking that the religion of the club, which is, by the way, a very specific interpretation of evangelical Christianity, which is itself quite diverse, they wanted to think the authority of the school was conflated with the authority of their faith. So at first, I kind of thought they were a relic of the American past. And it turned out, the more I learned, I was really wrong about that. And, you know, the more I learned about the clubs, the more I heard from my friends about the clubs who were affiliated with Westmont College, which is an evangelical college. They knew a bit about it. The more concerned I frankly became, I was really stunned by the movement's legal sophistication, its determination, its very high level of strategic thinking. These clubs had been excluded from public schools for many years until they obtained a significant Supreme Court decision that allowed them in. So I published a book about that topic, not just Good News Clubs, but the larger hostility to public education among the religious right. I published a book about that topic in 2012, and over the years, I just kept digging deeper. And I discovered that, you know, Good News Clubs were just one small part of a larger attack on public education, and the attack on public ed was really just one small part of a much larger attack on America as a modern, pluralistic democracy. To your second point, as I was researching this movement and its infrastructure, its leading institutions and personalities, I started reading about the intellectual progenitors of the hostility to public education, the movement's hostility to public education, people like Robert Louis Dabney and Roussas Jean Rushdoony, and Doug Wilson's name kept coming up. And because he sort of cited these characters, Robert Louis Dabney was a 19th century, frankly, pro-slavery theologian. And Rushdoony was a mid-century theologian who was, I wouldn't say he was trying to enact slavery in our own time, but he seemed very, I would say, sympathetic to the institution of what he called biblical slavery. and was explicitly hostile to desegregation and certainly hostile to the idea of women's equality. So we can get into that more a bit later when we talk about Wilson and his role within this movement and the intellectual progenitors.
Evangelicalism taking over the public square. Freedom for me, they say, but not for thee. Catherine adds to what Paul Miller was talking about on victim and identity politics, that which Christian nationalists would never identify by, but it sure identifies them.
You know, the persecution narrative is key. It is the psychological mainstay of the movement. It draws this group together, which is actually quite a diverse group, draws them together around perceived grievances, and it prompts them to act in concert in ways that the leadership wants. I think it's difficult for people outside the movement to understand how a group that is largely white, not entirely, but, you know, on balance white for sure, largely Christian, on balance decently paid, those who make up the backbone of the MAGA movement, how is it possible that they feel as though they are the most persecuted group in society? The numbers certainly don't bear that out, but that's what they feel. But the persecution narrative accompanies a few other messages that this movement spreads, such as catastrophism, the idea that we're on the edge of an absolute apocalypse because of secularists and liberals and feminists, and they say dramatic measures are necessary in order to save our country. Now, that persecution narrative also reinforces another feature of the movement, which is the strongman reflex, I would call it.
Yeah.
Trump understands, look, the key to power in this movement is to appear to be powerful. They want a strongman to take on the people who are supposedly persecuting them, the woke libs. And that's the core of Donald Trump's appeal. And it's the core of the authoritarianism that runs through the movement. It's amazing. I mean, the persecution narrative gives them the feeling that they're entitled to rule because they represent the real America, authentic America, the founders' America. You know, religious nationalism is a form of, I would say, exclusionary nationalism. It's this idea of who gets to properly belong in the country and who doesn't. So I think it's important to understand that Christian nationalism is not merely the idea of America as a Christian theocracy or a Christian nation whose laws should be based on a very particular and frankly reactionary reading of the Bible. It's also a political movement. It's a movement that exploits religion in its organized quest for power. And, you know, they say that we need a strong man, someone who's going to break the rules because they say the rules are broken, you know, woke libs or, you know, that lady who unfairly got a promotion at her community college or whatever. That's the thing that's actually oppressing us. And only a tough guy can save us. So those messages, you know, the apocalypticism, the persecution narrative, and the idea that we need a strong man to save us, that makes up Christian nationalism. It's less about faith, you know, sincerely held religious beliefs, than more of an identitarian marker. It's frankly a form of identity politics. And that's what's driving the Republican Party today.
For a group that condemns others for their persecution complex, think Black Lives Matter, they've sure got their own. Listen closely to Trump, Vance, and the rest of the more identifiable nationalists, and you'll hear this. We've been beaten down, and our rights have been stripped from us. They're going to keep doing it. Christians are being persecuted for singing psalms in public, for tearing down satanic idols, and praying. We need to rise up, fight, and take back our rights. Doesn't sound terribly different from any other real persecuted group in American history. The nationalist persecution is a perceived persecution. Let's go back to Paul Miller on that statement Catherine made in the middle of that clip. This is largely white and middle-class movement committed to preserving their identity and culture.
So I think the sort of the intellectual error that a lot of people make here is they read a history book and they recognize that the ideas and the institutions of freedom and democracy and equality, they first came to kind of fullest fruition in early modern Britain. Right, around the 17th, 18th century, parliamentary democracy with a Bill of Rights really kind of comes to its fullness in the United Kingdom. And then that passes to America through the British lineage, right? And we just sort of copy paste a lot of the British ideas and institutions as we create our new nation. That's all true history. It is not destiny. This cultural heritage, this history, isn't the only way you can get to democracy or uphold and sustain democracy. And I say that because I know the history of democracy. All around the world, there are countries of various levels of being an open society or a democracy or some kind of republican form of government with protections for rights that aren't Anglo and they're not Protestant and they're not even Western. And that says to me that the ideas, institutions of an open society are separable from the Anglo-Protestant context. They first arose within the Anglo-Protestant context. That does not mean the Anglo-Protestant context is the necessary precondition for all future possible forms of an open society. That's also why I tend to be a bit more relaxed about cultural change in America. Because, yeah, our Anglo-Protestant culture has changed radically in 2.5 centuries. We're barely an Anglo-Protestant country anymore. We're still a democracy. And I'm pretty sure non-Anglos and non-Protestants like democracy. That's kind of why they come here, right? People don't come to America in order to destroy it. Usually, you know, mostly, there's a few terrorists out there, but, you know, the vast majority of, you know, refugees and immigrants who come here because they know this is a land of opportunity and they want to escape the shackles of the old world. And so that's why I tend to be a bit more relaxed about the possibility of cultural change. And by the way, prospects of democracy around the world. I think that democracy is adaptable. There's a few quotes out there. Ronald Reagan back in 83 said something to this effect. Or maybe it was I get the two quotes, one from Reagan, one from Bush. The quote goes something like this, that these ideas, America didn't invent them and we don't own them. They are universal and they apply to everywhere. I'm butchering the quote, but you understand.
In order to preserve this identity and culture, you need to exclude others and the religious freedom. The influx of immigrants that is causing a national identity crisis can only be overcome by limiting freedoms. Paul continues.
Yeah, so I think I'm going to interpret your question and say, why is religious freedom and disestablishment a good thing?
Yep. No.
Well, first, it's in the Constitution. But more importantly, I think it's in the Bible, right?
Okay.
So as a Christian, I want to know what justice looks like, and I want to know how earthly governments should govern. And I look to Scripture, and I see Romans 13, where the civil government is given the responsibility to uphold order and execute justice. That's all. there's not a long list of other responsibilities governments get. Or deeper back, we look at the Noahic covenant in Genesis chapter 9,
yep.
Where God makes a covenant with all creation, not just with his chosen people. He makes a covenant with all creation. So this applies to Christians and non-Christians alike. Makes a covenant with all creation and says, I will never destroy the earth again. Fill the earth, subdue it. Here's the animals, have them for food. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. And in doing so, God is giving a grant of authority to humanity to maintain order, to use violent coercion against violent evildoers. That's what government is, right? So God is, in that passage, commissioning the institution of civil government. But again, let's look at the characteristics of the government he's commissioning. It is a covenant with all humanity. This is a civil government for all people. It's not just for one tribe or another tribe. It's government that should govern for the good of all, not just one tribe. It's a government that is provisional, dedicated to the preservation of civilization and nothing more. The Noahic covenant is not a redemptive covenant. It's not like the covenants through Abraham, Moses, David, and through Jesus, which are redemptive covenants. The Noahic covenant doesn't aim at that. It just aims at preserving the basic foundations of civilization. And so that is what civil government should aim at. It should aim at preserving the basic foundations of human life on earth in this mortal age. And God does not give humanity permission to punish crimes against God. It is whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. We are authorized to punish crimes against our fellow humans. We don't punish crimes against God. We don't punish blasphemy, apostasy, or other religious crimes. Okay, God has created an institution with the authority to regulate our religious worship, and we call that institution the church. In Matthew chapter 16, Jesus gives the keys of the kingdom to the apostles. Keys, that's that is a symbol of both authority and also restriction, right? It's how you keep people out of something. We're keeping the world out of our business as the church. We, the church, the apostles who hold the keys, guard the church from the world's usurpation. The church uniquely has the unique prerogative and authority to proclaim the gospel of Jesus, to uphold a display of God's glory, to be the body of Christ, and Caesar may not usurp those authorities. When we blur the distinction between church and state, what we're actually doing is inviting Caesar to take over our church and to proclaim the gospel on our behalf. We're outsourcing our job as Christians to Caesar. Read a book of history. That never turns out well. Mm-hmm. What kind of gospel does Caesar preach when you give him permission to do that? He preaches a gospel that is convenient to Caesar. It is not the gospel of Jesus. It's the gospel of Caesar. It's the gospel that props up whatever empire he is propagating at the moment. That's the gospel Caesar will preach if you start to blur those boundaries. It is important for Christians to guard the purity of the church by keeping Caesar out of our business. Grateful for Caesar, pray for him, that he governs wisely and well, paves the roads, please. There's a pothole outside my house. But aside from that, you know, keep your hands off of my church. I'm going to just keep on talking, if you don't mind.
Go for it.
There's a law passed in Louisiana recently mandating the display of the Ten Commandments in public classrooms.
Yep.
And of course, the ACLU has sued. And there's a big furor and hullabaloo. And the question is, should we or shouldn't we allow the Ten Commandments be displayed by mandate, forcibly, you know, displayed in public classrooms, public school classrooms? And here's where I'm going to draw the line. I'm not sure this is a very popular way to draw, but here's what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. The Ten Commandments is often divided into the first table and the second table. First table is, you know, no other gods, no idols, respect the name of the Lord, and honor the Sabbath. It entirely regulates our relationship with God. Mm-hmm. That's outside of Caesar's jurisdiction. And Caesar has no business displaying the first table, commenting on the first table, endorsing the first table, rejecting the first table. Caesar should keep his business out of the first table of the Ten Commandments. Those do not belong in a public classroom. They belong in the church. Mm-hmm. The second table, don't murder, lie, cheat, steal, commit adultery, covet, envy, that regulates our relationship with our fellow human being. And by the way, it expresses a universal natural law mm-hmm. that is reflected in basically every religion, every civilization, every culture, every philosophy in human history. Put the second table in public classrooms and in courthouses and in the legislatures. They need it too. Put it up put it up everywhere, in every public park. There should be no objection by anybody anywhere. I think Muslims and Jews should celebrate the display of the second table of the Ten Commandments. And by the way, if you want to put up a verse from the Quran that prohibits murder, I'm okay with that. Hmm. I'm okay with anything that says don't murder, lie, cheat, steal. Put it up anywhere. So display the second table of the Ten Commandments wherever you want, but keep the first table in the churches. I don't think Caesar has any business putting the first table up anywhere.
Religious freedom doesn't come at the cost of a robust Christian faith. It comes as the fruit of that faith. All people are made in the image of God, whether Christian or non-Christian, atheist, Buddhist, Taoist, spiritual, or nothing. Therefore, all people are deserving of the same love and respect. Because the Christian nationalist is threatened, though, because their heritage, their culture, and way of life is on the line, they've got to take matters into their own hands. Here's William Wolfe, one of the leaders of this movement, an executive director of the Center for Baptist Leadership, on what he's calling Christian nationalists to do to preserve their identity.
And if we have ever lived in a point in time in American history since then that we could argue that now is a time to arms again, I think we are getting close. Now, Davies sets that out and says that it is right, even though as Christians we seek peace, that when the enemy is pressed upon us, if we fail to heed the call to arms, then we are acting as cowards.
The enemy is the woke and the liberals, and anyone allowed in this country who isn't white and doesn't identify as Christian. Here's another example of limiting the rights of those who don't act, think, talk, or look like us. Here's Michael Shover, pastor of Christ Redeemer Church. That church is the denomination that Doug Wilson founded, the CREC.
People of God, what is the faulty, crumbling foundation that Christians need to remove in our land before we can successfully rebuild our civilization? What are these old ruins that need to be swept away before we can continue to rebuild and have the grace of God renew our nation? I humbly submit to you that it's the First Amendment to the Constitution.
In order to rebuild that which has been destroyed, or at least supposedly destroyed, we must do away with the First Amendment. The right to free speech gives too many liberties. The only speech we can have? That which we agree with. For a movement that so vilifies the woke and the libs, whoever they are, they sure sound like them. And here's yet another. Nick Fuentes is a former YouTube influencer who embraces everything you think of when you think of Christian nationalism. Rights are for Christians, not for anyone else. They've got to be destroyed.
There is an occult element at the high levels of society, and specifically among the Jews. So many of the people that are perpetrating the lies and the destruction on the country, they are evildoers. They are people that worship false gods. They are people that practice magic or rituals or whatever. And more than anything, those people need to be, when we take power, they need to be given the death penalty. Straight up. And I'm far more concerned about that than I am about even non-white people or mass migration. These people that are communing with demons and engaging in this sort of witchcraft and stuff, and these people that are suppressing the name Christ and suppressing Christianity, they must be absolutely annihilated when we take power. This is God's country. This is Jesus's country. This is not the domain of atheists or devil worshippers or perfidious Jews. This is Christ's country.
This has been a lot. I don't say this to sicken you or to cause you disgust, though I don't doubt both are happening. I bring these up to equip you. The fruit of modern-day Christian nationalism is backward-looking. No, not just morally, though I'd agree, but historically. They find their bedfellows in the Confederates. Doug has fancied himself a neo-Confederate in various ways, an apologist for Southern slavery, or at least it wasn't that bad, you guys. They were Christians. The Unionists were the baddies. Sure. Okay. Let's talk to a Southerner, a real Southerner, about this. Repeat guest Russell Moore, editor-in-chief at Christianity Today, on this fascination with the Confederacy.
That's what's so kind of pitiful about all of that, is it really is kind of cosplay. Almost every neo-Confederate I know is a Yankee wannabe. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Almost everyone. I mean, you'll have people from the South who have kind of complicated sorts of feelings because they do. I mean, my grandmother had real problems with the 4th of July because 4th of July, what happened in Vicksburg with the embargoing of food and people starving to death. And so she had this, I mean, but she grew up with people that would have been veterans of the Civil War when she was very little. So you had that kind of memory, but there's kind of a complexity. But the sort of wave the battle flag, you know, Stonewall Jackson, Robert L. Dabney sort of neo-Confederate stuff, they're almost always Idaho or Minnesota or something like that. And it's not just that I find it morally offensive, although I do, and theological offensive, although I do. It's also just kind of pitiful.
Here's one of those neo-Confederate LARPers, live action role players, and legitimate slavery apologist, Joel Webbin, on slavery.
And then there's like a last bastion, you know, like a final resistance in this little town, Moscow, Idaho. And they talk about, you know, how simultaneously this is going on, you know, with like Russell Moore. And then over here, you know, in Nashville, there's a Fight, Laugh, Feast conference, you know, and this is going down and Doug Wilson's there and these guys and they just say what the Bible says and they don't apologize and they're not embarrassed. I have spent, to my shame, to my shame. I thought I was cool. I was not cool. It's embarrassing. It is embarrassing that I, for years, was embarrassed by the Bible. Not all of it, but there were certain parts that, yeah, I'd be embarrassed about, like slavery or something like that, you know, like,
yeah.
And whereas now, you know, I had somebody recently on my show, you know, and they brought up slavery, you know, and they're a Christian, and but you could tell it was a little bit like kind of embarrassed, you know, and they were saying, you know, but like, you know, kidnapping, and so the African slave trade, America, you know, like man stealers, that was a crime, you know, biblically and punishable and atrocious in the sight of God, and so America has bad roots, and I paused them for saying this. Well, just for the record, real quick, the founders weren't going to Africa and stealing people. They were buying them. They were buying them. So who stole them? Africans.
whoa. You can't go there, man. You don't have the melanin to talk about such things.
Right. Yeah, well, that's the beauty. That's the beauty is I don't have to be ashamed. I don't have to be ashamed, exactly, but rightly dividing the word of truth, black or white, doesn't matter. But you're right. Like, I know you're joking, but I, you know, it's just like, I was like, man, I'm embarrassed about the Bible, or I'm a white dude, I can't talk about it. And there's just such freedom. And I'll be honest.
So free, like, it's so much freedom.
So much of it came by seeing another guy.
Yeah.
Right. Because that's the thing, is like that you're scared and you stay in your little corner, you stay on your little leash because you're like, I don't know what'll happen. I don't know what. But when you see some other guy do it and you're like,
oh, yeah,
that's the worst. That's the worst thing that could happen.
Absolutely.
Vice writes an article about you. Russell Moore won't invite you to his birthday party anymore. Like, that's it.
Oh, thank God, Joel. I thought they were stolen. That would have been far worse than buying them. Thank God they were bots. That makes it all better. You remember the conversation we had with Nick Geyer, one of Doug Wilson's former professors at the University of Idaho? I wonder where Joel got that one. There is a problem among Reformed Christians. A big problem. Here's another Confederate apologist and avowed racist, Michael Spangler, a former OPC pastor who's divested from the ministry for, among other things, anti-Semitism and racism. Here is an article that Michael Spangler wrote, Christian Race Realism, Part 1, Introduction, on July 1st, 2024, on PactumInstitute.com. And here are two sections from this article. Race Realism Defined. Race realism is a recognition that mankind is divided into distinct races, that the differences between the races are large and relatively permanent, and this racial diversity ought to be acknowledged, celebrated, and defended. And here are the differences between the races, because they are large. This means that race is not a matter of mere skin or mere geography, though we may name races after their skin color or country for convenience. Rather, race goes deep, extending, as we'll show, to countless other realities: physical, cultural, intellectual, moral, and spiritual. These men are such a joy, right? The fruits of the Spirit seem to exude from their every pore. I wonder what they'll think when they arrive at those pearly gates, when they behold every tribe, tongue, people, and nation worshiping the Lord of Glory. Not to mention our Savior is an ethnically Jewish man with a lot darker skin than he is ever depicted with. This fruit is bad. More than bad, this fruit is disgusting. Unbefitting of a follower of Christ, let alone a functioning citizen in the nation and broader world. So when a faithful Christian and non-Christian reply to these men, they rightly call them out as racists, more concerned with upholding white nationalist identities than our common identity in Christ. Here's Catherine Stewart with more.
Yes, they're being used to shut down the teaching of American history. You know, the fact that we had institutional slavery. And that's a really wonderful, like, the process of emancipation is a really interesting process.
Yeah.
Draws on some really fascinating sort of philosophical traditions. And these kinds of processes should be provide a great moment for a teaching point. And then if you look at the consequences of slavery and racial redlining and segregation, so these are really important features of our American history that should be taught, but that is not the same thing as critical race theory, which is right. A very specific, I would say, theoretical construct that was taught only in some little corners of some law schools or some graduate schools.
Yeah.
And it's not taught at the K-12 level.
any call out of racist or slavery apologist of a white supremacist is then filed in the folder of CRT. You're called woke, liberal, anti-Christian, a DEI agent, you name it. Catherine continues with the reaction of Christian nationalists to these claims and the culture wars they stoke.
Well, absolutely not. I mean, if you look, let's just look at the abortion issue. They spread the lie that Democrats all want abortion until the moment of birth and even after birth. This is a lie you hear all the time. You know, in my 15 plus years of researching this movement, I go to a lot of right-wing conferences and strategy gatherings and meetings, and they're always going to repeat this lie that Democrats want abortion after birth. Well, it's simply not true. There are laws against infanticide in every state. And also, most people want access to birth control and want to limit abortion to the moment of viability, which I think is, well, now it's limited in dramatic ways in almost every state. And also, people want to prevent the need for abortions by access to birth control. If there's it needs to be an abortion, have it be like in the earliest times. You know, medication abortion, I think, is carried out in the earliest stages of pregnancy. And if there's a later term abortion, of course, it's often to do with maternal care. I mean, this is a little sensitive here, but, you know, I had an abortion to save my life when I had a pregnancy go awry. Mm-hmm. You know, frankly, pregnancy isn't always a walk in the park. No. Sometimes
not even historically has it been a walk in the park.
Oh my gosh, no. I mean, yeah, so they spread these lies, but the sort of lies that they spread, the sort of ginning up of the culture wars is these ideas aren't really generated from the rank and file. Often they're generated from the top. The lies are generated from the top. You know, I think recognizing that most Americans, including most Republicans, approve of abortion in some cases and at some stages, they've had to flip. They find new culture war areas to get people really upset about. And like, for instance, a lot of the trans issues, whatever you think about those issues, those aren't necessarily issues that are affecting the day-to-day lives of the religious right leaders, the sort of Christian nationalist leaders will push those issues over and over again, almost as a distraction. I mean, you have to ask all the time, why are we talking about this thing over here that doesn't really affect your life? And not that thing that's affecting your life every single day, whether you have, you know, decent workplace conditions and mm-hmm. fair wages and access to healthcare and overtime pay and a decent public school that you can send your kids to. That is, you know, that a book ban thing is another thing. Like there have been so many efforts to ban books in libraries that don't even frankly exist in those libraries, or maybe there's one book they object to and it's among many thousands and maybe it was not checked out at all last year, but all of a sudden, you know, you've got these school board members being harassed and accused of teaching critical race theory when no critical race theory is being taught in their schools. You know, I have a second friend is a yep. second grade teacher, teaches second grade math, and he had parents coming to him saying, I want to see your textbooks. Are you teaching critical race theory? And he's like, let me explain to you. Let me show you my books. I'm teaching second grade math. But he's like, why am I all of a sudden getting harassed by these very upset parents? It's because they've been propagandized and fed a lie.
You can only sell Christian nationalism if you can provoke enough fear. If you're selling, your people are under attack, your liberties are being squashed, persecution is coming your way, then they'll buy a kill, enslave, or ship anyone who doesn't look like me. Let's take everyone else's liberty away but ours. Let's make sure they're subjugated, so we're not. We've talked through issues of race, immigration, culture wars, identity politics, and more through the lens of Christian nationalism in particular. But this comes from a certain strand of the far-right Republicans who were birthed in the 70s and 80s during the rise of the Mormon majority. I spoke with Nap Nazworth, one of the foremost scholars on this movement, to find out more.
I'm Nap Nazworth. I'm an executive director of the American Values Coalition, which is a nonprofit organization that's concerned about right-wing political extremism and misinformation. My background, I've a doctorate in political science from the University of Florida, specializing in religion and politics, and my dissertation was on the Christian right. I also worked for the Christian Post as the politics editor for 8.5 years So also in that position, observed and reported on the activities of the Christian right.
Expanding our view to the whole of the religious right, that from which the Christian nationalist movement came from, let's talk about the religious right. What is it?
So I look at it as a social movement, which social movements themselves, if you think of like the civil rights movement or the women's movement, other types of social movements, their boundaries are very fuzzy, right? There's always like, there's a core that you can identify as the groups, the organizations, the leaders that are part of the movement, but the boundaries aren't as clear as like, say, an interest group, where an interest group, you would have a particular institution where you say, okay, this, you know, you have a formal leadership, formal employees of the institution, and they are a C3 or a C4 or something. You know, they have official status and that sort of thing. And oftentimes they'll have buildings and staff and all these sorts of things. A social movement, it's more gray than that. People can go in and out and depending on the issues and things like this. And the Christian right itself, this new generation of the social movement of the Christian right began in the late 70s. Most historians would say 1979 probably, and began with some local issues regarding schools were often cited as sort of the origins, and then became a force within the 1980s and were very active in getting evangelicals into the Republican Party. So before 1979, evangelicals, especially white evangelicals, were mostly Democrat or just didn't vote in high numbers at all. And so they were very active in getting this group who was not traditionally Republican voters more active into the Republican Party. And so we initially starting a lot with like TV preachers were like the main sort of leaders of the Christian right in the 80s. Then they became a lot more sophisticated in the 1990s, a lot more institutionalized in the 1990s. They learned how politics works and how to use the levers of power better. There was this learning process that took place in the 1990s. And then I think sort of looking back on it now, when I was there during the George W. Bush administration, I think that's really sort of the peak of the Christian right in terms of its political influence, especially within Congress and within the Republican Party.
The religious right is a sociological movement not unlike the civil rights and women's rights movements. Make sure you don't tell the Christian nationalists that. It's interesting Knapp would say that the religious or Christian right peaked in the 2000s during the Bush presidency, because doesn't it seem like there's more power there than ever? That's where things get interesting, because while it may seem the religious right, which I use sort of coterminously with Christian nationalism, is more powerful than ever, they're but a pawn on Trump's chessboard. Where did they come from?
Yeah, for sure. And it followed the pattern that often a lot of social movements have followed, which is as the social movements become more institutionalized, their leadership changes from more of a mobilizing type of leadership, sort of inspiring, charismatic, mobilizing type of leadership, to more professional leadership that is less focused on mobilization. They're less focused on expanding the tent and more focused on maintenance. Maintaining what they have, maintaining the social movement, in this case, maintaining the Christian right. And so you get sort of that professionalization that happens. Generally, almost all social movements, this is what happens, and it's happened with the Christian right, where you get the professionals who come in and replace the sort of first charismatic, mobilizing type of leadership.
One of the things that animated the Christian right before they rose to power in the 70s and 80s was segregation. Unfortunately, it wasn't fighting segregation. It was fighting for segregation. You heard in the last episode about the rise of private and home schooling, which, among other things, many other things, was a response to the desegregation of public schools. Here is our friend, Joel Webbin, on the civil rights, right in line with his historic Christian right brethren.
it's like a glass case of this de facto constitution. You put it over the actual constitution. So the actual constitution no longer is a hedge or a protection or a defense or even a threat to your progressive agenda, because every time somebody defers to the constitution, it will be viewed through this, you know, this progressive lens, you know, the Civil Rights Act and blah, 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 blah.
Joel doesn't say it, though he implies it. The Civil Rights was a constitution which replaced the Constitution. Know what that means? The original Constitution did not afford the same to minorities that the Civil Rights Act did. It did not amend the Constitution. It did not allow discrimination based on race, sex, or religion. But when your nationalist program exists to uphold your rights and not another's, so that you and your people flourish while others are pushed out, you can't have a Civil Rights Act. And one of the leaders of the Civil Rights Act, Martin Luther King Jr., isn't looked well upon, even though he was a Christian.
You know, I just think of like guys like George Whitefield or Jonathan Edwards, or like they were like good Christian men. Like, I think a lot of people are going to be surprised, you know, when you get to heaven and, you know, you're spending eternity worshiping Christ next to Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee and Jonathan Edwards, you know, and you know, George Whitefield and Martin Luther King Jr. is in hell. Like, I firmly believe that. You know, I think a lot of people are going to be really frustrated when they realize that there were a lot of good men.
He's convinced King is in hell, perishing for his sins. He can't imagine a Christian who fought for civil rights and did not view Americans according to a particular skin color or political affiliation. Christian nationalists exist for Christian nationalists. But this hasn't always been the case. Here is Nap Nazworth on what historically animated the Christian right. It might actually surprise you.
Yeah, so they, of course, most people think about the core issues of abortion and same-sex marriage. And yeah. And definitely, like, during the Bush administration, same-sex marriage was a big issue. And, of course, they were always pro-life. But, yeah, there's been some interesting changes. So one that comes to mind, so immigration was not something that the Christian right really was much involved in. Yeah, I don't think they were involved in it at all when I was studying them during the George W. Bush administration. And I remember during the Obama administration, when I was the politics editor, and I went to an event in D.C., there was someone from Family Research Council there. Mm-hmm. In the news was Marco Rubio had supported this bill in the Senate that got passed in the Senate, this immigration reform bill. And then it was headed to the House. So it was kind of like in the middle of all that. So immigration was like front page news, especially within the Republican Party. And so there was a person there from the Family Research Council. And I was like curious. I was like, because I didn't see them taking any position on these. And I asked him, like, what's FRC's position on immigration? You know, are you going to do anything or make a statement there? And he said, they don't think about it as one of their issues. Hmm. Like, we're on the family issues things. Immigration is, you know, it's an interesting issue, but it's not one of our issues kind of thing. Today, they're all over talking about immigration. They do, you know, make statements about immigration and talk about a lot and all this kind of stuff. So they do see it as one of their issues today. So there's been that sort of shift. Yeah. And then another interesting thing. So I was talking about how social movements have sort of gray boundaries. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely, so in my dissertation, I talked about there's like these 10 or so core Christian right interest groups. And then there are some that I saw as sort of on the periphery of the Christian right, meaning that they worked with Christian right interest groups. They had some sympathies on some issues, but then not others, right? So there's been organizations like the National Association of Evangelicals, which I listed as a peripheral group, where they would seem Christian right in some issues, but they have been very involved on the immigration issue. Others like Prison Fellowship were really sort of taking the lead on prison reform issues. I would see them as a peripheral group, but they would bring along these Christian right groups as well on the prison reform. And you know, a lot of that prison reform that got passed during the George W. Bush administration, that was an important bill that got passed. And a lot of that was the Christian right that was behind it as well. So these things do tend to change over time.
This goes back to what Paul Miller was discussing earlier in this episode. Lest you think Christian nationalists or their Christian right forefathers are a static bunch, they shift and change with the times. What animates them now may be immigration, but that's because they feel like they're no longer the majority. But that may change, and I doubt for the better. You see, they're a reactionary bunch. They change policy with the times. Don't let them convince you otherwise. It also depends on who funds them. They sound virtuous and like knights of valor on social media and political TV, but they move when their donor tells them. Here's Catherine Stewart on the money behind these movements.
I think the movement would be nowhere without this cadre of incredibly wealthy donors that contribute huge amounts of money to the movement. The movement is incredibly well-funded. Let's remember, this is a leadership-driven movement and also organization-driven movement. And the organizations derive hundreds, many hundreds of millions from these donors. And I'll just take a single organization that's, you know, vital to the movement, which is the Alliance Defending Freedom. It's just one of the many organizations that are part of the right-wing legal movement. They have an annual operating budget of $102 million per year. I heard that recently from their, you know, VP of communications. That's an awful lot of money. A lot of money buys a lot of law. And that's just only one piece of a much larger legal advocacy sphere. So there are two really important facts to know about the donors of this movement. The first is that wealth inequality in America has risen, and our political system has frankly become more corruptible. So the influence of these donors has grown exponentially. As wealth inequality has risen, they have more money to spend, and they're frankly a lot of it investing it in the destruction of our democracy. And the second, I think, the more important fact is that many of them are much more concerned with right-wing economic ideology than they are in right-wing positions in the so-called culture wars. But they use the culture wars. They understand that these are identity issues. They're going to get the rank and file, you know, all hyped up, the sort of gender stuff, the stuff about marriage. So they use those almost like shiny baubles, shiny objects as a way of distracting the rank and file from their real aims, which are to justify the enormous wealth that they've accumulated and indeed to increase it through low taxes or no taxes for the rich, minimal regulations of the businesses that they're involved with, no environmental regulations because a lot of these donors derive their wealth from extractive industries, et cetera, fracking and sometimes oil to some degree. So in fact, some of the funders have become, frankly, captive to a hard right ideology that is, if anything, more extreme and even more at odds with the religious values of the rank and file. You know, this is a movement that claims to stand for family values,
yep,
but it's driving support for hard right political candidates whose policies are intensifying wealth inequality, eroding rights for the workforce, and making it so much harder for most American families to succeed.
There was a book published over the summer, Shepherds for Sale, that reported on the liberal money backing the progressive political agenda focused on evangelical elites. It caused a social media firestorm, to say the least. Everyone was worried about George Soros and his seemingly unending pockets, and that the issue in the church was liberal creep. It might also be the Republican creep. I'm neither Republican nor Democrat, so I have no dog in this fight, but it sure seems like a lot of money is being funneled into this far-right movement, as well as the far-left movement. I'd encourage you to follow our social media for more. We'll help you trace it. Today's Republicans are nothing like yesterday's. Gone are the days of moderate politics. The Bible is a weapon. A weapon we use to beat others into our image. I asked Catherine about the difference between old and modern Republicanism.
The thing to remember is that Donald Trump is where he is, and the authoritarian movement is where it is because of Christian nationalism. For many years, the Republican Party saw this cadre of conservative Christians and said, well, we can make use of them. They reliably vote for us, but we don't have to do everything that they want. But over decades, there's been this massive investment in the organizations of the movement. and they become much more powerful and effective, much better funded. And as a consequence, the guardrails of the Republican Party have fallen away. And today, it's the extremists who are really setting the agenda. This is not the Republican Party of 15 years ago.
No.
You know, throughout American history, political parties have typically undergone radical changes in several ways. You know, either they disappear like the Whigs, or they shift their constituency dramatically, even as they keep the same name. And I think the Republican Party is going through the latter transition in a very major way. They're adopting these very extreme positions because they're no longer in control of the, like, the leadership of the Christian nationalist movement, and the funders want something very different, and there's many of the sort of thinkers. So I would say that the party of, shall we say, Reagan and Bush and Romney is now dead. And what we really have is a far-right wing and Christian nationalist party whose agenda is serving the billionaires at the top by enacting these libertarian, hard-right economic policies, pushing endless culture wars and disinformation and conspiracism and a narrative of fake persecution in order to control the rank and file and get them to do what they want. They know very well if you can separate the people, the little people, from the facts, they're much easier to control. And so they have no qualms about doing that.
We keep going back to it because it's true. Trump changed the Republican Party, and the church came with it too. Here's a Christian nationalist on one of those changes that might come back and then repeal the 19th Amendment to the praise of all the patriarchs.
The reason why I have grown to despise democracy is because it's not we the people. It's we the some people. And who are those people? Non-elected officials. Like what democracy, what it gives, lends its strength to is instead of having elected officials that have power, is a raw universal, because that's what we have, is a universal democracy. Everyone is allowed to vote,
right?
Everyone. And just for the record, you know, yeah, I think the 19th Amendment should be repealed. I think that because, well, first and foremost, because I'm a Christian, you know, and that is the Christian position. Oh my gosh, that you're saying that? Yes, that is the Christian position, is that households should not be divided against one another. So it's not just elevating a male vote, but it's elevating the household vote. We're saying that that society, if you break it down to the basic building block, is not atomistic as individuals, but molecular, being households. The way that God sees humanity is he breaks them down to families.
Mm-hmm.
And so that it's not just random individual atoms all, you know, bouncing around together, and you know, 350 million atoms bouncing together in one nation on one piece of land, but it's families. And so by repealing the 19th Amendment, just for the record, it's not just trying to take away a female vote, but it's trying to say, no, there's a family vote.
Right.
There's a household. And it's like, well, where do women get their voice? Well, where women get their voice is from their father, from their husband. If they're not married, it's from their father. If they're not married and their father's dead, it's from their brother, it's from their uncle, it's the men in their lives that love them.
Here's Joshua Hames, host of the Reformation Red Pill podcast, and you'll hear more from him in that podcast later, talking with Joel Webin about what's on the chopping block in this new nationalist republic, which I know is an oxymoron.
Christian nationalist wand, we wake up tomorrow in a Christian nation, a Christian nationalist nation as you're describing, all right? There's a lot of fears that people have. Here's one of them. Will women have the right to vote tomorrow if you wave that magic Christian wand?
No.
Okay, why not? I want to get into why not. Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
Because if we had a Christian nation tomorrow and women did have the right to vote, we would not have a Christian nation within 50 years.
And if you'll allow me to backtrack slightly, here's John Harris speaking with Joel Webin. He just keeps showing up. About Southern slavery in strikingly similar terms to the way Doug Wilson talks about it in Southern Slavery as It Was and Black and Tan.
The conditions of slavery are not what we are led to believe. There were bad conditions for some people, there's no doubt. But if you look at the slave narratives, Fogel and Ingerman show that about 60 to 80% of them don't have anything negative to say about their life in slavery.
Back to Paul Miller. He puts a fine point on what Catherine Stewart and Nap Nazworth have been describing. Nationalism walked in the door that Trump opened.
So Trump, sometimes people mistakenly say that Trump has no ideology, and that's false. Trump is definitely a nationalist. I think that he came to his nationalism first through economic nationalism. There's a book out there that traces 40 years of Trump's public comments, and this is the single most consistent thing Trump talks about. He talks about trade protectionism and protecting American manufacturing jobs and striking a good deal and things like that. And he comes through it through immigration as well. He's always been an immigration restrictionist. So his entry into nationalism is a bit more, I think, sort of in his heart, he's more of an economic nationalist. But he's looked around at the landscape of fellow nationalists, and he sees the Christian nationalists out there who are fellow travelers. And he recognizes the power of that voting bloc. And so if you listen to him on the campaign trail, he's very explicit about it. There was an event 2-3 weeks ago in which he very openly said, you Christians should get out there and vote for me. I'm a Christian. You're a Christian. You are my beautiful Christians. Christians should vote and regain their power, something to that effect. And this is not new. He said this in 2016. He said it in 2020. He's made a very explicit, deliberate outreach to Christians as an interest group. Now, I want to be clear. It's good for Christians to vote. I'm not against that. Mm-hmm. It's good for Christians to run for office. It's good for Christians to seek to gain political power. It's not wrong to seek power. But what he's doing is saying, you vote for me as a Christian on the basis of your Christian interests. You should vote for me, and I will protect Christian interests and advance Christian interests. And so he's participating in the reduction of Christianity into another tribal label. And so Christians aren't, in a sense, Christian ethic isn't universal. It's just another tribe. And that's how Trump is treating Christians. And many Christians are very happy to go along with that. And I think it trivializes our faith. I think it reduces what should be a universal message. And it may be a violation of the third commandment.
Yeah, name of the Lord your God in vain.
C.S. Lewis wrote an essay on this about the third commandment, in which he explained why he opposes the formation of a quote-unquote Christian party. I guess this was maybe a proposition in the United Kingdom back in the 1940s. They were going to form a Christian party. And Lewis said, no, that's a bad idea. Because if you do that, you are implying that your party is the expression of Christianity on earth, and that if you're not with us, you're anti-Christian. And if you are with us, you're a Christian. In other words, that party would be exercising the keys of the kingdom, usurping the church's authority. And Lewis thought that might actually be a violation of the third commandment of taking the Lord's name in vain, of misusing Jesus's name to name a political agenda rather than the body of Christ, which is where Jesus's name belongs. That's, I think, the argument against Christian nationalism. Christian nationalism is trying to make their party into the Jesus party, the Christian party. That's the party where all Christians go and all Christians have to vote. And I'm not quite saying Christians should never be partisan, because there's probably a line. If we were Germans in 1933, I hope all true Christians would vote against the Nazis, right? But I don't think that's America in 2024. I'm really, really nervous about saying this is the Christian movement. You have to be this if you claim to be a Christian. I don't like that aspect of Christian nationalism at all.
As we look towards concluding this episode, I want to explore what the fruits of a positive vision of Christian political theology looks like. I'll have a full conversation with Vincent Bakehote and David Koizis later on in the series to flesh that out, but what are the basics of a political theory that doesn't disenfranchise and strip liberties, but gives liberty for all? Paul Miller and I use a recent ruling in Louisiana to erect the Ten Commandments in public classrooms as a test case.
Yep. And the church does that by exercising the authority of the keys. As a Baptist, I believe that means church membership. We exercise the keys if somebody I have covenanted with in my local church goes around violating the first or second or third commandments, or any of the Ten Commandments, in an unrepentant way, we put them out of fellowship.
Yeah.
Now, if it's the first four commandments, that's about all we do. We put them out of fellowship. If they go on murdering, then we also report them to Caesar.
Yep.
We don't do that if they violate the first or second or third or fourth commandment. We don't report that to Caesar because Caesar's got nothing to do with that. We report them if they lie, cheat, steal.
So, what can we do? What does this religious freedom look like? So often fear is that which dilutes our national identity. How might plurality of religious tradition actually thicken our identity? Here's Paul on where to start.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right that many Christians fall into a de facto Christian nationalism for lack of alternatives, because the Christian nationalists are the ones most vocal and seemingly most successful, though I dispute that, in pushing against the progressive left. And so they're like, well, I hate the left, so I got to go with the people who are punching the hardest. And I think that's, first of all, not accurate. There are others punching against the left. I think Christian nationalists are actually not that effective. They posture culturally, but politically, they don't actually accomplish much. They lose election after election. They really do. And they don't pass laws. So that's a whole other thing.
Yep.
The alternative, labels are so frustrating, but the alternative is to try to preserve our inheritance. And I'm here to talk about the Constitution. If you want an answer or a label, what is the political agenda we should defend and support and champion? I would call it natural law republicanism. Mm-hmm. And another way of putting that is the U.S. Constitution. Huh. I think our Constitution actually, and the Declaration as well, and the Constitution as amended to outlaw slavery, I think the Constitution remarkably captures a lot of what I would design as an ideal regime with my understanding of the Noahic Covenant and natural law and a regime of institutions designed to preserve civilization while preventing government from overstepping its boundaries. That's a really tough balancing act, and it's precisely what the founders were concerned with. So we've got an inheritance here, and it is endangered by both sides, by illiberalism on the left and on the right. I'm a single-issue voter now. The Constitution is my single issue. And I invite all Christians and all Americans to join me in that. I think preserving the Constitution is probably the foremost issue of the day.
Now we conclude with final thoughts and advice from Russell Moore, Paul Miller, and Catherine Stewart. I asked each one of them to speak to those listening who are fearful of our times, religious plurality, changing cultures, and living as Christians and non-Christians as citizens in this world. I'll start with Russell Moore.
Well, I mean, the first thing I would say is in most of these kind of strongman sort of guises, it's shtick. And you can see that by what's happening is a playing to a particular subculture. So in many ways, it's very similar to sort of old modernist Protestantism. Mm-hmm. That said, we want to adapt ourselves to a particular culture and strip away or minimize the things that the culture doesn't want and maximize the things that the culture does want. Harry Emerson Fosdick is doing that with 1920s Manhattan.
Yeah.
Doug Wilson is doing that with a homeschooling convention.
Mm-hmm.
So you're doing the same exact thing, which is to say, let me find out what my constituency wants to hear and let me say it better than they can say it themselves. That's not moral courage. That's something else altogether. And the second thing I would say is compare this stuff to Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And see how small Jesus seems to be in these movements. And by that, I don't mean the atonement. I mean Jesus himself, the person, and how small the talk of actually what it means to be conformed to Christ in terms of who Jesus actually is and how Jesus behaved would be. I mean, there was one of these kind of Howard Stern of the so-called Christian right types saying not long ago, Jesus is not particularly helpful here, what came to be a Washington cliche was when Michael Kinsley said a gaffe is when someone unintentionally tells the truth. You're not supposed to say that out loud. That kind of thing is there. And then look at the fruit of this. I mean, Jesus told us that we are to look at what comes out of the root of something and how it expresses it. And what you can see looking around is wreckage after wreckage after wreckage, ruined lives, destroyed marriages, abused children, plagiarized books. That's not good fruit. And I think the reason that a lot of people are drawn to it is for the same reason that they're drawn to Bill Gothard and other people, which is to say we're living in a really chaotic sort of world. And by that, I don't mean like right now is particular. I mean, post-fall life is chaotic.
Yeah.
And that's especially true as people are getting older and they're starting to take more responsibility and they don't know what to do. And so there's a sense of, if somebody will just tell me, do this homeschooling curriculum and my kids will end up Christians. Do these practices in terms of my marriage and I won't have to worry about her divorcing me. Do these sorts of spanking and parenting practices and my children won't end up hating me. And I can follow those sorts of things. Problem is, not only is that not the way of Christ, it ends up doing ultimately exactly the opposite of what it pretends to do. And so you see different flavors of this, whether it's independent Baptist separatist fundamentalism or prosperity gospel Pentecostal life or Gothardite basic principles life or Doug Wilson, whatever you want to call that. It's all doing the same sort of thing. It's just branded in different logos. The end result is just not good.
Here's Paul Miller answering the same question.
Cultivate hope and gratitude. Particularly in election year, it is easy to give in to angst, anger, despair, wrath. In order to cultivate gratitude and hope and avoid the other stuff, turn off your TV and turn off social media. If you want to stay informed, read a good newspaper or magazine or a couple of them. Those formats of information, they engage your mind more than your heart, and they will force you to think, not just react with feeling. Recognize that social media and mainstream TV are for-profit corporations who make money off your bad emotions. So stop giving them your clicks. Just turn it off. And instead, spend time cultivating hope and gratitude. Read a book of history, read a newspaper, read a magazine, and dwell on what is true and good and noble and pure and uplifting. And just doing that will improve our public square quite a bit. Always speak with graciousness and truth. Being involved in politics is not an excuse to lie, cheat, steal, spin, win elections. That's not an excuse to violate the commandments. You always have to speak with graciousness and with truth. I'm trying to do that. I want to acknowledge my own failings in that, but I want to exhort everyone to aspire to that with that graciousness.
Catherine Stewart gives advice for the non-Christian perspective, both to those who are Christian and trying to wade these waters, and those who identify as non-Christian and figuring things out.
Well, I would say that first and foremost, the Republican Party of today is politicizing and exploiting religion for politics and power. And many American Christians do not represent this as a representative of their faith. They reject the politics of division and conquest that this movement represents. And there are, in fact, so many Christians of many denominations, including non-denominational Christians, who are speaking out against it. I think about groups like, oh my gosh, there are almost too many to mention. I'm just going to throw out a few names here. It's by no means comprehensive, but I think about Vote Common Good, Baptist Joint Committee. I think about Christians Against Christian Nationalism. I think about Faithful America, New Evangelicals. There are so many other groups that are speaking out against this and saying this is really not representative of our faith.
I'll let Catherine continue and close us out.
Well, first I'd say that religious pluralism is a really an important and a feature of the American project, and we should be proud of it.
Yep.
You know, this is a religious freedom is the idea to worship any faith that you want, any sacred idea or deity. And those of us who are members of religious minority groups, we are Americans too. We are deeply patriotic. Many of us are deeply patriotic, and we belong here too. I want to say, you know, another thing is that, you know, members of the religious right are still a minority of our population, but they are overrepresented at the ballot box because they're so organized, they're networked and have been quite disciplined in their messaging. And in a country where 40 to 50% of people don't vote and an additional number have their votes essentially taken away from them because of voter suppression and gerrymandering, you don't really need a majority to win elections. All you need is an organized and committed minority. But that organization, this sort of structural organization, is really key to defeating the politics of conquest and division that the movement represents. So I've been a longtime follower of Ralph Reed. He's one of the movement's, I would say, most astute and seasoned strategists. And at one point, I was at a conference and he said, pay no attention to the polls. Our numbers are shrinking. All that matters is who turns out on election day. You know, he's right about that, because if you can get out the vote in disproportionate numbers, you can really dominate in election cycles. So that's really the key. So those of us who believe in the values of democracy, equality, rule of law, true religious freedom, and justice, all of which represents the best of the American promise, if we can work together, get out the vote, and maybe set aside any, you know, it's a big, noisy country. We're going to be a, you know, disputatious group. We're not going to agree on everything. But I think, who was it? Ronald Reagan, who talked about the 80% friend, the person who agrees with you 80% of the time is not your 20% enemy. That's your 80% friend. We can work together on the values that we share. Maybe we can help create a more perfect union.
With that, we close out our four episodes on the Christian Nationalist Project. I know it was a lot, got heady at times, was scary, and somewhat confusing. But my hope is this gives you grounding in the political aspirations of Doug Wilson and the movement he has helped fuel. It can be difficult living as a minority in a majority world. Ask anyone who's not white and living in a predominantly white neighborhood or city. We all share the same humanity and are created in the image of God, both male and female. But this doesn't mean all our cultural proclivities or traditions fall in line, nor do we eat the same food, speak the same language, or share the same history. If your end of the world has been the same for so long and things start changing, how do you react? Do you reach for the emergency lever? Do you pack up your things and leave? There was a person in the first century Palestine who took on human flesh and entered into a world that did not receive him. He created all things, for there was no time when he was not. He knew perfection, he lived perfection, and yet his mission given to him by his father was to seek and save the lost. He came into a culture that despised him, mocked him, beat him, spat upon him, and ultimately crucified him. But that wasn't the last word. He was assumed cursed when he took upon the cursed. He was assumed dead when he defeated death through his death. And he rose again from the grave because death died. He was vindicated of all charges against his name. And in that vindication, your sin and mine was forgiven. He ascended to the right hand of his Father and your Father, that he might bring people from every group with him. This heavenly bliss will have no racism, no curse, no vitriol, no hatred, where men and women will enjoy full fellowship with one another, and every color under the sun will form a beautiful mosaic, that which the image of God promised from the very beginning. While the fruits of nationalism are bad to its very core, you can be sure the fruit of Christianity is the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. The fruit of the gospel brings all things together when we tried so hard to separate it. I want to thank Paul Miller, Nap Nasworth, Catherine Stewart, and Russell Moore for their time and expertise. I hope you learned as much from them as I did. Next week, we've got a special. I had the chance to sit down with Thabiti Anyabwile about Doug Wilson, racism, slavery, and so much more. That's next episode, and Excursus, a conversation with Thabiti Anyabwile on racism and Southern slavery. See you then. Sons of Patriarchy is brought to you by the administrators of Examining Doug Wilson in Moscow in partnership with Peter Bell. It's written, produced, and edited by Peter Bell. Original music, sound design, and mixing by Aaron Feeney. This series wouldn't be possible without the dozens of abuse survivors whose bravery and vulnerability make it what it is. Every episode was sent to them before being published, and their feedback, edits, encouragement, and eventual approval make this what it is. May your voices be heard far and wide. Thank you.
Since 1981, Unbound has connected people like you with families worldwide on their self-directed paths out of poverty. A brighter future is possible for these families when we all walk together. Sponsor a child today, and you'll help a family take the first steps on their path. Change their future in just one click. Start walking with your new friend today at unbound.org/walk.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.